Hello, I'm Richard Penson, and on behalf of the CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's podcast entitled The When and How of Maintenance Therapy in Endometrial Cancer. Today's program is supported by a joint educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck and Company Incorporated. I am Richard Penson, a physician at Mass General Brigham and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. I'm also the IRB chair at the Dana-Farber/Harvard Cancer Center in Boston. And I would very much like to welcome my colleague, Ignace Vergota, the professor of gynecologic oncology from the University of Leuven in Belgium. Welcome, Ignace.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to discuss this topic with you.
Exciting times. And you are one of the great orchestrators of evidence-based advanced in this field. And actually, I was listening to a podcast with Mansoor Mirza, and he cited you as one of his most important mentors. So accolades all around, and thank you for all that you've contributed. I'm going to give a brief introduction to maintenance therapy, and then we're going to look specifically at endometrial cancer. So the history of maintenance therapy is interesting. So for a long time, we were distracted with bigger is better. And in childhood leukemias, longer gave a better chance of cure. And so we really didn't take that on board till Jonathan Lederman really in an inspired move changed from olaparib is no better than Doxil to Study 19, and maintenance therapy was sort of recaptured as an important strategy. And the Rustin data for a long time had contracted us to least toxic therapy for the least time with our palliative goals, but times have changed. And so, especially in endometrial cancer, it is a new season, which is very exciting. So, Ignace, when it comes to selecting patients with advanced and recurrent endometrial cancer for maintenance checkpoint inhibitor therapy, with all of the US approvals that have taken off right now, just give us your perspective on all of these options.
Well, the first thing I would like to say is that maintenance therapy in advanced and recurrent endometrial cancer is important, but it should be different for different patient groups according to the molecular characteristics. And I don't think there is one drug or one type of drugs that fits them all. So I think this is the most important one. We have, of course, the MMR, where IOs probably are the most important. We have hormonal therapy in the most specific molecular profile. We have for the P53, selinexor. We have HER2 and so on and so on. So probably we can discuss that later. But for me, one of the main messages of this moment is that we have been defending molecular classification for the past 10 years. Also, in the ESMO/ASCO guidelines, we promoted very hardly, also in the adjuvant setting, that we should take molecular classification into account. But this holds even more true for the advanced and recurrent setting, where we have clear data that the molecular profiling, and then I'm not only talking about the PO and the NMR P53, but also new targets really can make a difference for our patients.
So the tension between sort of lumping and splitting, if you when you're in clinic sitting with a patient, how much on your mind is overall survival as the definitive metric? I mean, I one of the many things that has transformed my thinking of the checkpoint inhibitors is that with 40% crossover in RUBY, there is still an overall survival advantage, which is just amazing. So when you're talking looking at a patient with endometrial cancer, have you dismissed the sort of lumping and the big outcomes in clinical trials? Is molecular subclassification everything when you look at your patient?
Of course, overall survival is the most important. But we should not only look to overall survival, but also to progression-free survival and very important quality of life. So if you can extend the PFS and add better quality of life to it, then I don't think OS should be proven. But of course, ideally, also in ovarian cancer and other cancers, but also in endometrial cancer, if you can prove an OS as a primary endpoint, statistically significant, is of course the proof of the pudding. But it's only in rare cases that you are able to prove that.
Right. It is staggering in the era of targeted therapies in lung cancer, PFS, and so rarely we see an overall survival advantage. Yep, we do, but not always. And especially, as you say, as we hone down on these subsets with smaller and smaller groups of patients in them, it becomes impossible to demonstrate overall survival advantage. Tell us a little bit of the history behind selinexor in the P53 wild-type patients. One of my kids, actually, now a medical student, worked with Jim Cusack on using this drug as a radiation sensitizer a very long time ago. How did you get into that story, and how did you see the potential to exploit it as a maintenance therapy?
Well, as a matter of fact, maybe you don't know that, but selinexor was developed at my university and then later sold to Karyopharm. So just to give you a little bit of background, 12, 15, 17 years ago.
Outside of trading, good job.
Outside of trading, it was developed, yes. And it's clear that if you have a drug that can prevent that tumor suppressor proteins are exported, you might have a good try. That was a philosophy. And then I was contacting Karyopharm and trying to investigate this drug, which was at that time mainly in hematological disease tested. I could convince them to test them in the science study, which was a phase one, phase two study, to look at selinexor and gynecological cancer. And we had more than 100 patients treated with ovarian, endometrial, and cervical cancer. And we saw responses between 10 and 20% according to disease. But what was most striking to me at that time, that those patients who responded, responded very long. That's why then the SIENDO study was started with, as a matter of fact, as an academic trial with my university as sponsor and the BGOG as sponsor. But doing a randomized study, phase three study as an academic group is difficult. So once the trial was running well, but not fast enough, it later changed to what we call an ENGOT Model C or industry-sponsored trial. And you know the results of selinexor, the intention to treat was just negative. That was P06 or something like that. But we looked, of course, what happened according to the molecular profiling, because we knew that if P53 was mutant, that giving selinexor could not work. So that's why we looked, and that was also planned, to the P53 wild type. And then we saw, certainly with longer follow-up, we have now almost 40 months follow-up, and we just published it in Gynecologic Oncology with Vicky Mercola's first author, that the P53 wild-type patients and who are pMMR, that the PFS was almost 40 months, 39 months versus 4.5 months in the control arm. So that was the basis why we are now doing the export EC042 study, or ENGOT EN20, we call it in Europe. Where we do the same trial as in the SIENDO trial, comparing maintenance selinexor after response on chemotherapy in first line, advanced or recurrent disease. We compare placebo versus selinexor, but only in the P53 wild type patients, which is a population where we expect that it's the only possibility to get a clean positive signal. And like I said, the long-term PFS data are very encouraging. And also the preliminary OS data are very encouraging and have been presented already, but they are not mature. But we hope, like you said, for OS, of course, also with maintenance at least in next, but that remains to be proven, but in a specific population.
Right. And Vicky Macker presented that data at ASCO 2024 as a oral presentation and with a big splash. So that is very exciting. When you are thinking strategically about how to advance the field, how do you divide your time up looking at sort of promising basic science advances as opposed to it's sort of just thinking how are we going to mix these things together to best help patients in the future? Do you have a worked out philosophy or you have sort of perfect intuition? How do you approach it?
Maybe we'll come back to that if you talk about new drugs and ADCs, but I always think that in today we should have a target and a good hypothesis before we embark on big phase 3 trials. Mm-hmm. It's also what you did with Selinexa, we and also other drugs. We try to find a hypothesis and then go further and try to prove whether it works or not. Like in ovarian cancer, 5 phase 3 trials with IO and high-grade serous ovarian cancer, without any good rationale to do that, this is something which, even though I'm also the PI of one of these 5, this is something which I always had problems with, and so also with the desmoid fedotin and cervical cancer, I always have tried to find a target which is highly present in this tumor when we talk about ADCs, and then a very active payload to try to find the good drug for the good population.
I hear you. I think that following the science is just a really good way to do things. It's not hope, it's desperation sometimes in other settings. So would you just review your perspective on the checkpoint inhibitor treatment and maintenance study in endometrial cancer, the 4 big trials now that have shown advantage and have led to approvals, at least in the US?
I think there are 5.
My apologies.
Yes, we have the RUBY trial, we have the ATTEND trial, we have energy GY018, and also the MITO END3, which was recently published in oncology, which I really love. And of course, also the DUO E trial, which also has an arm with only IO. The round up alone, the second arm. I think they all show very clearly that in the DMMR, the deficient MMR patients, IO is the drug that they should get and should get as soon as possible. And maybe another discussion point, I would say as soon as possible, but also as long as possible. But we can come back to that. I think they all show very clearly and significantly that in the DMMR patients, chemotherapy plus IO is better than chemotherapy alone in first line, recurrent or advanced endometrial cancer. The big problem is, 1, the PMMR, the proficient ones, and 2, what to do with PARPs. That's the 2 big questions to me, PARPs in addition to IO. Mm-hmm.
Go on.
As you want. I wanted to continue on the proficient ones, proficient MMR. I think all but 1 are negative when you compare the PFS and the proficient MMRs, the ATTEND, the Ruby 1, the MITO trial, and the DUO-E trial, they are all negative with hazard ratios between 0.9 and 1.1 for IO in addition to chemotherapy. We only have the energy 018, which is really positive. Clearly, I think we could say pembrolizumab is better than the other 3 drugs or 4 drugs, even though I believe pembrolizumab is probably the best one. As IO, based on all the approvals I have had, I have hard to believe that one trial is so positive with a hazard ratio about, I think it was over 54, and all the other trials being negative. So I am not a believer that we absolutely need to give, based on one of the five trials, to add IO to chemotherapy in first line recurrent endometrial cancer. Based on that. And then the second question, which I wanted to discuss with you, is what with the PARPs. We have the Duo E and I have the Ruby Part 2. Problem with Ruby Part 2, it's comparing dostarlimab plus niraparib versus nothing. So it's difficult to say that it's better. And we don't know whether in PMMR the effect of the combination is based on the addition of niraparib or of dostarlimab. Duo E, we have luckily a third arm with only durvalumab, and the arm with durvalumab and niraparib, of course. And there you see clearly that the effect, like I said already, of durvalumab is mainly driven by the DMMR patients, while in the PMMR, like I said already, it's negative. But when you add olaparib, you add something in addition. The question is, does that mean that all patients with PMMR need PARP plus IO? I don't think so. Why?
No.
Because if you look on the analysis which my good friend Mansoor Mirza showed in ESMO last year in the part one study of Ruby, it was clear that in the NSMP patients, the non-specific ones, that for PMMR, probably the effect is driven by the P53 mutant patients and not by the P53 wild type patients. Unfortunately, I don't have seen yet the data for the molecular classification for Duo E and for energy GYL18. But we have another study which was also presented at ESMO last year. It's a randomized phase 2 trial from the French group, Utula, where they did not give IO, but after response in first line, they added olaparib or not in maintenance. And they did not see a difference globally in the phase 2. But again, what they saw is if the patient was P53 mutant, you saw an effect of PARP. And in addition, they did also an HRD testing. If they were P53 mutant and had HRD, the curves even split more. But that was an exploratory analysis. But it's hypothesis generating for me that PARP in addition to IO is probably needed in the P53 mutant patients. And if you have an HRD testing, if they are HRD deficient, molecular recombination deficient, then I believe probably the addition of PARP to IO makes sense. That's for a patient with PMMR who is P53 wild type endometrioid. I don't see any reason to give PARP, but also not IO.
No. Again, a mixture of the experience in clinical trials and the evidence from the bench to bedside sort of understanding. How much do you think what we're seeing is an artifact of GY018 being so much a bigger trial?
I'm not sure it's an artifact, but if you're doing five trials, that one is positive.
Yeah.
If for the DMMR, it's clear all five are positive, so there is no doubt at
no
all.
Doubt.
It's logical. That's what we expect. But the PMMR, I think the findings are correct, but I would not say, for me, with the four other trials, that this is enough, like I said, to give all patients PMMR IO.
Yeah. So you commented about treat them, I think you said, for a long time or something like that. So no specifics, but how do you think about dose, 3 weekly, 6 weekly? How do you think about duration of treatment? Maybe start with the division mismatch repair, the DMMR.
Well, if it's tested in 6 weeks, which several drugs have done, I think, of course, in a maintenance setting, IO every 6 weeks is preferred, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Again, for the patient, it's certainly better to come to the doctor every 6 weeks instead of every 3 weeks. And in addition, I believe that IOs are a good maintenance therapy because the side effects are there, but they are usually reversible and are limited when you compare it with chemotherapy or combinations with TKIs or ADCs. I think once you're over the start and you know how to treat clearly thyroid changes, level changes, and this type of things, I think, like bevacizumab, these are drugs that are well tolerated and can be used in maintenance therapy, in my mind.
Yeah.
If it's tolerated so well, why would you stop? Well, Merck always say you have to stop after 2 years because we don't have data for longer. But if I have a patient with DMMR who's responded to chemotherapy and IO, and I'm after 2 years, and the patient or the insurance can afford to continue, I would certainly continue.
So, checkpoint inhibitor for life?
It's the same question with PARP.
Yeah, a very different sort of concern in PARP inhibitors. Yeah. But
if you think you have cured the patient, if you are convinced you have cured the patient, you can stop.
Yeah, I think probably the PARP, reducing it to 2 years max has really influenced me. But I do a PET CT scan at 2 years, biopsy anything that's of any concern. And if it's histologically, a pathologic complete remission, I do stop at 2 years. Occasionally, there's a quirky thing. I have a patient with a recurrent choriocarcinoma that has the patient went abroad, stopped their pembrolizumab, and the disease came back. That's pembro for life. And then I talked to Mike Seckel, who said, oh, yeah, probably 6 months will be enough. So there's just not enough data all too often.
Not data, but if you have
yeah.
In front of you, and she has a complete response, is tolerating it very well.
Yeah. I think I've had so much experience with looking, sort of beaming love into the eyes of patients who, as they wrestle with their sort of sense of abandon, stopping maintenance therapy, that and talking them into just doing 2 years or less with PARP inhibitors. I think I'm sort of now equipped to support people through that. Let's move up to upfront. Some very exciting with data with upfront studies, with the goal not of overall survival, so you live the longest possible, but truly improving the cure rates, the outcomes for curative intention. Tell us a little bit about checkpoint inhibitors in that setting.
You're referring to, first of all, the LEAP-1 study, I think. Well, in general, I think we all have accepted that this is a negative trial. I said from the start, in my opinion, the bar is very high to compete with paclitaxel carbo in first line in the endometrial neoadjuvant. And pembrolizumab is very difficult. And that's also what you see, that overall the ITT is the same. But patients who have received adjuvant chemotherapy or neoadjuvant chemotherapy seem to do better with pembrolizumab than nivolumab, which is logical.
Mm-hmm.
Problem, if I may, is that they included patients with a gap of 6 months.
Yeah.
Which is short, which is logical to me to say, normally, I would not retreat again with paclitaxel and carbo. Again, 6 months. So I would love to see the data with patients who have had at least 1 year or 1.5 year in between, and then compare it. Then I would be even more convinced that education has had adjuvant effects on cargo, and it's, for instance, 1 year or 1.5 year in between, that you immediately have to go to endocrine pembro, or you can go to the combination of chemotherapy with or without one or other maintenance therapy, which we have available now.
Do you have clinical experience of salvaging patients with dMMR tumors and progression on a checkpoint inhibitor by using lenvatinib or a different antiangiogenic?
Curing not well. Maybe you know that I did the and published the first lenvatinib only trial with 135 patients with lenvatinib alone. So we treated a lot of them with lenvatinib alone, and we didn't cure them. And I felt that at that time we used the 24 milligram dose, so in the high dose that was a really toxic drug. So luckily now it's 20 milligrams, and it's a good combination. So in second line, it's one of my preferred treatments to use. Then in first line, and that was the question, what do I think about LEAP-1? Well, I think in general, I would say, unless the patient is recurring very fast after the adjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy, I would prefer to use paclitaxel combo in most patients in first line, not in second line, when they just have received chemotherapy and then progressive, and there is no discussion with the best regimen in second line if they didn't get IO already. Of course, that is probably more and more the standard, especially in dMMR, as we discussed before.
Yeah. So I completely agree. I want to make a sort of highlight what you said about the 6 month platinum free interval. I do think, I mean, in my mind, I think that the taxanes are at least as good as platinum in the in endometrial cancer as a generalization. And so to extrapolate too quickly from ovarian cancer is a bit risky. So yeah. In the last bit of the discussion, I would love to get your thoughts about the exciting data from the antibody drug conjugates, and especially with their relatively narrow therapeutic index, but just a great way to deliver a toxic payload. How are you particularly thinking about those integrating into maintenance strategies?
Well, we have a whole group of ADCs which we are exploring, and of course we have the anti-HER2, which to me is probably the most promising. We have the Pandestiny results, again presented by Vicky Mecker, I think at ASCO 2024, with response rates of 57% in second line, which patient is HER2 2 plus or 3 plus. If it's a 3 plus, it was even, I think it was 85%. Yeah. So this, again, we have to do the phase 3, and NCOT and EOG are doing that trial and comparing it. But trastuzumab DXd, deruxtecan, is certainly one of the possibilities we need to set as one of the most exciting combination or ADCs in endometrial cancer.
It is very exciting. Unfortunately, it's time to wrap up our discussion. So to briefly summarize, we have hit a new era where it is the standard to give concurrent chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitor with maintenance checkpoint inhibitor to all of our patients with deficient mismatch pair tumors. And then, as Ignace reminded us, the challenge to really get the best outcomes for the other groups of patients is excitingly set for potentially the addition of PARP inhibitors, the integration of antibody drug conjugates, creative things like selinexor, and the new generations of drugs that are coming. So very exciting. To receive CME CE credit for today's program, please complete the post-test evaluation, and you'll be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Remember, this is a part of a six-point podcast series on gynecologic cancers. Next month, I'll be hosting a discussion about the expanding options for immune checkpoint inhibitors in frontline advanced and recurrent endometrial cancer, and I hope you will be able to join us. We'll be archiving this and future podcasts in this series on the Oncology Hub at cmeoutfitters.com, where you can find a number of excellent resources for both clinicians and patients. So again, Ignace, thank you for joining us for this fabulous and really important discussion. Thank you to you, our audience, for participating and for providing the very best care for patients with endometrial cancer.
Thank you.
Thank you.